Hello, you are tuned into Research Review on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting from the unceded territory of the Musqueam people at UBC. My name is Alirad Amari, and I'm joined by my co-host today, Gurman Gill. Each week on Research Review, we interview a researcher who is affiliated with the UBC community and discuss some of their latest work and findings and how they relate to broader issues in society.
Welcome to Research Review today. We're welcoming Dr. Mark McLaughlin to Research Review on CITR 101.9 FM. Dr. McLaughlin is a professor in UBC's Department of Chemistry, specializing in materials chemistry. Welcome on the podcast.
Thanks, German. Nice to see you.
And thanks for joining us. So first question I just want to start off is, like, tell us a bit about yourself and how you got interested in chemistry, because, you know, right off the bat, first thing I can see is that you did your undergrad, your bachelor's of science at UBC. Started off a while ago, so you probably went through a lot of the same chemistry courses that students nowadays go through, right?
I did, and a lot of them haven't changed that much in the last 30 or 40 years. But yeah, let me tell you, I started out at UBC in 1991, and I took a general science program. And I have to say, to be perfectly honest, that I found high school chemistry super boring. I had kind of decided I wouldn't go into chemistry after high school. But in first year, I got quite excited about chemistry. Also really enjoyed physics and math. And at the end of my first year, I didn't know what I wanted to study. So I made a pact with myself. I said, whatever my highest grade is, I'm going to enroll in the honors of that program. And this was at a time when you didn't get the grades until the middle of the summer.
Oh, wow.
So the middle of the summer, you have to dial up to get your grades. And I find out that it's a tie. My chemistry and math were both the highest grades. So I'd already made this pact, and I enrolled in the combined honors math and chemistry program for second year. And it just about killed me. So my first term, it was the most stressful period of my entire life. I couldn't keep up in either the chemistry or the math. So at Christmas time, I dropped the math and just continued on in the chemistry program. Never looked back. It was a smart choice. I love math, but I was more fit for the chemistry program.
And what Oh, sorry.
No, I would probably major in earth and ocean sciences if that were the case. Going with my highest grade.
I would be going for poli sci if that was the case. kind of should have, now that I think about it.
Right.
Yeah.
Could you explain what materials chemistry is for everyone listening?
Sure. Materials chemistry is studying materials around us, making new materials, inventing new materials. I became really passionate about materials chemistry during a undergraduate research experience that I had after my third year. I applied for a scholarship, summer research scholarship at McGill University, and went to McGill and worked in a lab where I was charged with trying to make an erbium doped laser. And I didn't even know that erbium was an element on the periodic table at that point. And I had so much fun that summer trying to invent new materials that I decided I wanted to be a materials chemist after that. So my research has taken me through inorganic materials, organic materials, biomaterials. We work on a whole variety of different types of materials that have interesting optical properties, interesting electrical properties. We've made materials in space. We've made materials on Earth, materials for environmental remediation, and materials for sensing, all kinds of different materials.
Yeah, I would imagine creating things that have never existed before requires a very special way of thinking, sort of different from some of the other sciences. Is there, like, the research methods sort of a bit different in materials chemistry?
I think so. You usually have a goal for either what kind of a particular property or properties that you want to incorporate into the material. And so you go back and you look at the literature and think about what types of materials might get you towards that target. But there's so much room for making new innovations. And for me, it's been all about having creative students that can come up with new and exciting ideas on their own. And I just help to corral those ideas and push them forward.
Yeah, definitely involves some more like creative thinking in there. When I was doing my honors thesis, like everything's sort of more guided and procedural, I guess, in some other sciences. Like in neuroscience, we sort of just like what let one discovery take you to another, take you to another, take you to another, and you sort of just branch out. But imagine in materials chemistry, it's more just like going one to bouncing around, so to whatever like new idea comes to you.
I think that's true, at least partly. Some of our work isn't really hypothesis driven, where we walk into the lab with a hypothesis, but it's more discovery driven. You know, I can give you one example. We just wanted to see if we could take, and I'll talk about this a little bit more after, this material called cellulose nanocrystals, which are obtained from pulp and paper. And we wanted to see if we can heat them up in water to carbonize them, make them into little carbon filaments. So we do that experiment thinking that we're going to get carbon, but instead we get gels when we open up the hydrothermal bomb. And it turned out to be a fantastic discovery that has led us into a whole bunch of new bio-based gel materials. And we're looking at these for exciting applications to develop new supercapacitors and alternative energy storage materials. So I think, you know, my advice to students is always just to keep your eyes open. We kind of have a target in mind, but the most interesting things are usually the things that don't work.
Yeah, I would imagine accidents spawn a lot of new materials. I mean, it's happened from everything from penicillin to Velcro.
That's right. Exactly. Yeah, there's a ton of famous materials that have been made essentially by accident.
Yeah. I guess more of a philosophical question. Like when you make material, like do you say you created it or is it more like discovered in a way?
Kind of depends on, well, that's an interesting question. It kind of depends on the particular material and how new it is. You know, some of the materials we make are truly new. And that would be more of a discovery, whereas some of them might be, maybe other people were working towards that goal and getting really close, and we found the final trick to make it work. And that might be less discovery and more just developing the material.
Excellent. We'll be right back here on Research Review on CITR 101.9 FM after one short message, so please stay tuned.
About 40% of UBC students experience food insecurity. Sprouts is hosting a weekly produce market from 10:30 to 1:30 every Monday in the Life Building. With produce from local farms, students are free to take whatever they want. Sprouts Cafe is open from Monday to Thursday and is offering 30 free meals a day, completely free and no questions asked. They also host Community Eats, a completely free hot lunch that is open for all. Stop by and support the Sprouts cause for sustainable, accessible food at UBC.
You are listening to Research Review on CITR 101.9 FM. So we're back now, and today we are interviewing Dr. Mark McLaughlin, a professor of chemistry at UBC. So in the past, but we've talked a bit with Dr. McLaughlin about how he's gotten into the field of chemistry, specifically about the field of materials chemistry and how new materials are created. Now, branching off from Grimand's question, which was a philosophical one, I want to ask a legal one now. So let's say that, you know, you either, however you call it, you create or discover a new material. So basically something that is a novel compound. This is something that, you know, hasn't really been synthesized before. Especially in the context of if this is like something that has commercial value, industrial value, it's something that, you know, it's profitable in a way, who would own this? Would it be you, like the team that discovered it, or would it just be that, you know, no one really owns this?
It depends on the discovery and how we pursue patenting. When we find a really interesting discovery that we think could have commercial value, then we file what's called an invention disclosure with the university, and they will review it, meet with us, and try and test whether it's going to have likelihood of bringing commercial value. And if they think it does, then they'll file a patent. And that patent would list usually me and my students as co-inventors. And then there's some things about how the patent gets licensed, depending on who your industrial partners were, or if you had industrial partners, what kind of deal is made with potential new industrial partners. But yeah, UBC is actually quite good at helping support innovations out of the lab reach commercial applications.
And what will be patented? Would it be the compound itself or the process which is used to create the compound, or both?
It could be both. So there's composition of matter patents, and then there's also application patents.
Wow, interesting.
So we have several patents, and they cover both areas.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Does that patent process become easier, like if you're in a private industry rather than working for the university?
Yeah, I don't know if it's easier, but you might have one thing is the university is dealing with a really broad spectrum of research, whereas in a patent office in a company, they might be very focused on just pharmaceuticals for cancer therapy, for example, and know all the literature in that area and know exactly how to structure a patent and how to pursue it. I think it's more challenging at the university, especially to identify what is going to be of commercial value when you have invention disclosures from Earth, Ocean, Atmospheric Sciences on new mining technology to, you know, cancer therapeutics or new materials from chemistry.
Yeah, does UBC end up taking a piece of that patent?
Generally, when patents get licensed, there's a share distribution. So I don't actually have any patents that have been licensed. But I think typically, if you license a patent that's, you know, first of all, UBC would be paying for the initial license or initial patenting costs, mm-hmm. and the maintenance costs, which are annual. And they would expect to get some return if the patent gets licensed to cover those costs and probably to share with the inventors down the road. So inventors do get some cut of the patent revenue, but it can take a while, and the university does get a cut as well.
That's interesting. It's pretty cool how the whole process works.
Yeah, I haven't really fully understood it all. We've got a few patents, but they were always in partnership with a company also.
Mm-hmm. So would that mean like the company basically contracted out for you guys to research something, or is it that you discovered and then went to the company?
So the company was paying us or providing some research funding to do mm-hmm. some work. And then we made a discovery in our lab. And usually that doesn't really involve the company. But because they have an agreement already in place for the intellectual property, then they get the first rights of refusal to use the technology. Mm-hmm. They could make a deal with the university to license it before anybody else.
Interesting.
Yeah. Going downstream of that, what makes you decide whether or not a new material is suitable for mass production?
Oh, so that's another issue. Mass production. I mean, you know, most of the stuff that we work on, we're working on the 1 gram scale or sometimes smaller. The biggest materials we've made are maybe like 1 square foot of something. What makes us think about going to mass production? I guess it would be if there was a company that expressed a strong interest in the material, or we thought that by scaling it up, we could get a lot of interest in it. You know, it's hard to excite company representatives when you show them some cool material that's only 1 square centimeter. Wouldn't it be awesome to cover an entire building with this material and it's the size of your fingernail? So we have not really pursued that avenue of trying to scale up materials to show them off for getting investors excited. But that would be the main reason, I think, that you would do that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, economically too, that must be a whole lot harder. Like if you think about all the money that came into just making that 1 fingernail size of a material to then just expand it to an entire building's worth. Would the same processes would even be applicable, or would you need to come up with some other new way of creating the material?
It would depend on the material you're making, but you'd probably need some new process entirely. You know, the industry likes to have roll-to-roll processing rather than batch processing, some kind of continuous process. And most of the things that we do in the lab are on a batch process. You know, to give you one example of something where we did scale it up, we were working with a company to develop new catalysts for catalytic converters on natural gas engines. So this company produces natural gas engines, and natural gas is mostly methane. And when it burns methane, methane is cleaner burning than gasoline. But one problem is a little bit of the methane escapes through the exhaust. It doesn't get completely burned. And unfortunately, methane is the least reactive hydrocarbon, and it doesn't get touched by a normal catalytic converter. So we had a project developing new materials that could be used in catalytic converters to oxidize methane to CO2, because CO2 is only about 1/25 as potent of a greenhouse gas as methane is. And they were having trouble meeting European targets for methane emission. And so we developed a really awesome catalyst on a 1 gram scale. And our testing showed that it was really effective. We were able to, it could last a long time. And they wanted to do a full engine scale test. We needed 100 grams of it. So the student working on this project did the synthesis 100 times in parallel, so that, because the equipment that we had would only let us make 1 gram at a time. And so she was able to make 100 or 120 grams of the material by working 24/7 for a few weeks using this equipment and producing 1 gram at a time until she had enough to do a full engine scale test.
Now, catalytic converters. So, you know, basically what you're talking about is that the on like an engine on a vehicle, the catalytic converter piece, that's what you were working on, the compounds in there, right? It's pretty interesting. Like catalytic converters, like there's been a lot of theft of them recently just because of the value of like precious metals in there. They're pretty valuable, I would say.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. So in fact, the catalysts that we're developing don't have precious metals, and they're still really effective. Mm-hmm. And that would be one of the big draws of these materials over existing or the materials that other people are exploring for this application.
So if you could theoretically like mass produce it, it would be way cheaper just due to the availability of the material.
Because like, that's right. So if you're going to scale this up, you wouldn't do it the way we've done it. You would get a catalyst company that has massive vats that could produce this stuff in a larger scale.
Because currently like catalytic converters, I know they have a lot of precious metals in them, like palladium, rhodium. So it's both very expensive, and I understand it's also very difficult to like recycle it as well.
I think it's really hard to separate the metals.
Yeah,
I can imagine just the entire process from like making the material to mass production is even like an arduous process with regards to time. Like I know in high school, like we were learning about the allotropes of carbon, and my high school teacher was like, oh, get ready for graphene. It's going to take over the world in a few years. That was 7 years ago.
No, you're right. Actually, it's amazing. Graphene now, they do have roll-to-roll processing for it, but I still think it's not easy to scale up. Like it's really expensive still.
Excellent. We'll be right back here on Research Review after one short message.
Join us every other Wednesday from 6:30 to 8 p.m. for Sam Squanch's Hideaway with your host, Anita B., as she plays all Canadian music with a focus on indie rock and pop.
You are listening to Research Review on CITR 101.9 FM. My name is Ali Rod, and along with my co-host Gurman, today we're interviewing Dr. Mark McLaughlin, a professor of chemistry at UBC. So far in the past bit, we've been talking about how in the field of materials chemistry, when a new compound or a new material is created, how the process of patenting, how the process of ownership works, and how an idea goes from being created in a lab to being mass produced and commercially used. So going ahead, Grimon, I think you had a question to ask.
Yeah. Moving on to another topic, to what extent does animal biology play a role in inspiring or even enabling the work you do?
So some of the materials that we make are inspired by nature. And I'll tell you a little bit about the material we do on photonic structures that mimic the structures of butterfly wings and beetle shells. Now, in nature, there's color everywhere, of course. But a lot of the color that we see in nature is from something called structural color. If you look at blue butterfly wings or blue feathers on birds, those are almost always due to structural color rather than pigments or dyes that are inside of the feathers. And what that means is that they have structural features on their surface that are spaced by distances that correspond to the wavelength of visible light. Visible light is typically around 400 to 800 nanometers. And on the surface of these beetles or butterfly wings, they have features that are spaced by 500, 600 nanometers. So that makes them iridescent. They selectively reflect that wavelength of light. Now, we have been making materials out of cellulose nanocrystals that have the same structure as some beetle shells. So cellulose nanocrystals are obtained from treating paper or cotton with sulfuric acid. Cellulose is the most abundant biopolymer in the world, and it's also the main component of all plant cell walls. What we do is we isolate these nanocrystals of cellulose. They're like about 200 nanometers long and maybe 5 or 10 nanometers wide. They're extremely small. You have to put about 1,000 of them end to end to be the width of a single human hair. So these are really tiny nanomaterials, but they have an amazing property. When you take a beaker of cellulose nanocrystals, it's a colorless solution. If you let the water evaporate, you get a beautiful colored iridescent film. There's no dye or pigment present, but they organize into a structure at the nanoscale. So what they do is they actually stack on top of one another in layers. The cellulose nanocrystals align in layers, and then the next layer aligns, but they rotate a little bit relative to the first layer. Next layer aligns, and you build up this helical structure where the cellulose nanocrystals are aligned in layers that rotate their orientation through the film. And when the distance of that helical rotation, which is called a pitch, matches the wavelength of light, it gets selectively diffracted. So cellulose nanocrystals organize into this helical structure spontaneously from water. It turns out that if you take a jewel beetle shell, which has a beautiful green iridescent color, and you look at it under an electron microscope, it has exactly the same structure. It has this helical structure, not of cellulose nanocrystals, but of chitin nanocrystals. And chitin is another biopolymer that's very similar to cellulose and found in all mushrooms and crab shells and shrimp shells. So we've been using this concept of structural color as inspiration to make new sensors and also new mechanical sensors, materials that when you stretch them, they change color. And we've been trying to make new decorative materials and ornaments and paints that take advantage of the structural color rather than dye or pigments.
So when you created the material, was it sort of like, oh, let's see this beetle shell, let's try to emulate it? Or did you like make the material and be like, oh, it's kind of like a beetle shell, let's try to make it a little more like that?
Initially, it was we were working with cellulose nanocrystals. And I have to tell you that this structure of cellulose nanocrystals was known since the 1990s. And we started working with cellulose nanocrystals in about 2008. But I didn't know about this organization of cellulose nanocrystals, even though that was in the literature. And my student working with cellulose nanocrystals, we were trying to embed cellulose nanocrystals in glass by condensing chemicals around the cellulose nanocrystals to make glass that had cellulose nanocrystals embedded in it. And then we'd remove the cellulose nanocrystals. That would leave us with a porous glass our application was to make hydrogen storage materials for hydrogen cars. But one day my student came to me and he said, I made my materials as always, but today it's colored. And I don't understand why the glass I made is colored. And we dug into the literature and learned about this structure of cellulose nanocrystals and then realized that, wow, it's the same as the jewel beetle shell. So at the time, we just stumbled onto it. We weren't using the jewel beetle as inspiration. But now we've started looking at other natural substances like crab shells and shrimp shells as inspiration for making new materials.
Yeah. So when you come up with that material, did you already have like a use in mind for it when you started making the material? Or was it sort of just like, well, I made this material, now let's test it out and see what it could do?
Yeah. With the cellulose nanocrystals, we were trying to make hydrogen storage materials just by making a porous glass. We wanted to make a porous glass with nanopores that could selectively absorb hydrogen gas and store them on their surface for releasing a hydrogen-powered car. And it turns out we made a lot of materials, tested them for hydrogen storage, and they're pretty poor. None of them had very high absorption at all. But when we discovered this colored form of glass, we knew we were onto something pretty interesting. So when you have this colored film of glass and cellulose, then you can remove the cellulose by burning it out of the pores, and you get a porous glass film that is now iridescent and beautifully colored and made of pure silica, pure glass. So we've been looking at trying to coat windows with this, either as a decoration, or also we can make them so that they're reflecting infrared light. One of the ideas is to be able to coat a window with an infrared reflector, and that would reduce the amount of heat energy that gets into your building and therefore reduce the amount of air conditioning that you need.
Wow, that's pretty cool. It makes you think about one thing that's interesting is when just you mentioned windows, is that I think in the future windows just might be looking a lot different than they are right now. We could have like windows that just change color to respond to like natural lighting. Really be helpful for like just energy efficiency.
I think smart windows are a really important direction, and there's quite a few companies that are working on developing smart windows. It's hard to get the right optical quality that we expect of windows, mm-hmm. and also some kind of incorporated function.
Yeah. Do you ever like spend a lot of time making a material that you're really excited for, and then you go to test it out and you're just like, wow, this is useless?
Oh, more often than I'd like to admit. Yeah. That we make a lot of materials that are pretty useless, but what I hope is that we always learn something new about the chemistry or something new about the science, even if the materials aren't very useful.
Now, you know, we talked about stuff that's useless. What about the things that are useful? What are some like interesting uses of new materials that you can see, things that, you know, in our daily lives that in the coming, say, decades could really be transformed?
I think there are huge opportunities to change things that we interact with all the time. Something that I'm really excited about is the idea of making biodegradable plastics or biodegradable computers, biodegradable smartphones. Now, there are more smartphones and mobile phones combined on Earth than there are people. And these are massively wasteful. So wouldn't it be great if you could make them so that they're mostly biodegradable?
Definitely. And one other question, because, you know, so earlier we were talking about catalytic converters in cars. Now, what about electric cars? Because I know one big thing that's coming up these days is about battery mining, the materials, the metals that go into these batteries. And there's really a lot of issues surrounding that nowadays, because, you know, we're seeing electric cars becoming more popular. So there's a question, is that where are we going to get these materials from? Will enough of these materials be available to satisfy global demand as it's increasing? And also, ultimately, how sustainable are these materials? How are they going to be recycled?
I think these are really important questions. And I wish I had the answers. I think finding clean, environmentally sound ways to mine massive amounts of metals that are needed for these batteries is going to be important. Mm-hmm. We're going to need new ways to mine. We can't do it the way we've been doing it forever. Just too wasteful. And the recycling that you mentioned is a really interesting question, because that's, these batteries have many kilograms of metals in them and they're mixed, and it's really hard to recover them easily. There's a huge energy cost to mm-hmm. bring them back to pure levels that we can use for other applications. I don't know what the answer is. Hopefully there's...
Go ahead. Recycling is like where the chemistry really comes into play, like coming up with some sort of chemical process that would be able to help basically recycle this into something that's useful again.
I think so. I think there's huge opportunities for chemistry to address that. You know, when I think about the problems in our society, like electric cars, environmental remediation, the atmosphere, these are all chemistry. Like, we really need chemists to step up to the plate and solve some of these problems.
Definitely.
Yeah, going back into the more philosophical, you spend a lot of time working with sustainable materials. And what is it exactly that makes the material sustainable?
I don't know that I have a really concrete definition of sustainable, but I would call anything that we're taking from our forests, you know, our forests are well managed in Canada generally, and I would call that a sustainable resource, one that can be renewed on a reasonable time scale. I think chitin from mushrooms would be a sustainable source. I'm excited about the idea of making new materials from mushrooms, because we can grow mushrooms on a pretty big scale. Using waste products from food, so not using corn itself, because that's a massive food source, but rather using corn cobs and the corn husks and the corn plant for different applications. There's a huge amount of waste in agriculture that we could take advantage of to make new materials or new fuels.
Yeah, definitely. So when you go into work every day, is like your main motivation to come up with these sort of new materials, or is it to learn more about nature and inform the literature?
I think, you know, I'm looking for new, interesting problems to try and pursue. Mostly I'm interested in making aesthetically pleasing molecules and materials, and then looking, once we've been able to make them, try and see what they could be useful for. One of the materials I'm really excited about right now is we've been making graphene oxide. This is from graphite. If you just take graphite, which is the material on the end of your pencil, and you oxidize it, you form these sheets of graphene oxide. And when it's diluted, it's a pale red color. But when you concentrate it, the sheets stack on top of one another with separations that match the wavelength of visible light. And suddenly it becomes a photonic liquid. It becomes blue or yellow or red, and we can change it using just a little bit of chemistry. And this is a pretty new discovery. We were not the first to discover it, but there's only been maybe two other papers in the literature on this. And I'm really excited about thinking about what we could do with photonic liquids where all the color is coming from structural color. You know, nature uses lots of photonic solids, and we're pretty used to working with photonic solids, but I think photonic liquids could open up some new areas.
Yeah, it sounds like you're very interested in sort of like the artistic almost side of chemistry.
Absolutely. We have a couple of projects actually with an artist in Vancouver developing new materials for potentially architectural projects or museum pieces.
Great. We'll be right back here on Research Review after one short message, so please stay tuned.
A Tribe Called Red is the Hallucination with their new record, One More Saturday Night, featuring Javier Mighty, Tanya Tagak, and more, out now.
Mama, Keep bringing up so good with
You're listening to Research Review on CITR 101.9 FM. My name is Ali Rod, and along with my co-host Gurman, today we're interviewing Dr. Mark McLaughlin, a professor of materials chemistry at UBC. So far in the past, we've talked about how new materials being created, they have different uses, how they can have the potential to really change our lives. And, you know, just one of the last few questions I have right now, going back, you know, because, of course, since you're a chemistry professor, you mentioned you're teaching chemistry courses. And one thing you mentioned is that, you know, the chemistry courses haven't changed much compared to back when you were taking them compared to now. But what is what future direction do you think, you know, chemistry education, especially, you know, at that, say, like high school level, undergrad level, it's going to take in the future? Do you think it's going to change the way that chemistry is taught or what is taught?
I don't think that it's going to change a lot in high school or early on in undergraduate programs. Probably I see more incorporation of practical ideas into the early curriculum. And we've tried to do that in first year chemistry, adding a few more vignettes from the practical world. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, chemistry requires you to kind of learn a language in order to go on as a major.
Definitely.
You know, mm-hmm. you need to learn those organic chemistry reactions. You need to be able to talk about different types of bonding and periodic trends. And unfortunately, some of that is kind of boring, but it needs to be covered. It's a little bit like... It's like learning French. At some point, you have to learn to memorize all those nouns and verbs in order to be able to speak the language.
Oh, yeah.
You're giving Alirod flashbacks.
Yeah. Chem 233, like there was the, you know, the SN2 reactions, the SN1 reactions. Oh, no. Just it got to a point where, like, on the exam, I think I was just, like, moving things around, just drawing arrows. Some of the questions I had no idea. So I managed to actually get a few half marks here and there. I just like dragged around what made sense, you know.
That's right. What I have to say that there's sort of two different approaches for a course like that. One is you can just memorize all of it and you can still get by. The other one is to see the beauty in kind of what would be positively charged, what would be negatively charged. Mm-hmm. And negative always attacks positive. And
yes, I think, you know, I kind of had a understanding of those like rudimentary basics, so that's kind of like what got me through the course. I know some people like another approach might have worked better out for me would have been just to like straight up like memorize everything.
Right.
I know a lot of people did that.
yeah.
And okay, so really now, I'll be honest with you, one last thing before we really wrap up. I'm going to show you something. So a while ago, I have this old laptop that was lying around, and I noticed it was like bulging. So it was kind of like bulging, and I'm going to show you something. It's the battery that I took out of this laptop, because once I noticed the bulge, I opened it up. It's basically this. So you can see it's basically like...
Holy cow.
This is like 10-year-old laptop. I haven't used it before. And I noticed like the computer case was like looking like it was about to blow up. And I guess it was the battery. So that's, you can see on this side, this is like how thick it usually is. And this side, it just expanded like that. So I guess this is a typical lithium ion polymer battery, it says on here. So I'm just wondering, as a chemistry researcher, what do you think was happening here?
Well, I think you got a leak. I think over time it probably came apart a little bit and absorbed some moisture, and the moisture reacts with the lithium to form hydrogen gas, which would mm-hmm. create pressure inside of the thing.
So is this dangerous right now, you would say?
Oh,
I should probably not keep it on my desk. It's been there for a few weeks.
You know, there's been lots of problems, not recently, but in the past, with exploding lithium ion batteries.
Yeah, and... there was this one on the news, actually, where there was an apartment fire recently in Vancouver where someone died.
Yeah.
It was a like e-bike, like electric bike battery, like a big one. So it's pretty large. And I guess like some of these are probably like cheaply made or they were like malfunctioning and yeah, can just like blow up or heat up, combust.
They're storing a lot of energy and it's like thermodynamically downhill for it to react with any impurities like oxygen or water.
Yeah, battery chemistry is like something I'm kind of like, it's just interesting for me just because of how like how much more important like batteries are becoming these days, and they're just becoming so ubiquitous, but at the same time we're having a hard time keeping up with the demands.
Yeah, there's so much battery technology being developed, and you know, it's still lots of optimization of the lithium ion batteries.
Yeah. Excellent. So I think, you know, that's probably, we touched upon a lot of different topics today. Anything else you have to say, Grimaud?
No. Do you have any final messages for anyone interested in maybe pursuing a career in materials chemistry?
Yeah, come talk to me. I love talking to people about materials and show them all my samples. My office is filled with different materials that we've made.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'd definitely say like, you know, when I was like in first year of undergrad, I guess chemistry did seem like a bit intimidating, a bit boring. But I guess, especially after today's conversation, really delving into these topics, I can see, as you mentioned, like once you learn about the fundamentals, it really comes down just to like discovery, problem solving. It's pretty interesting just seeing what you can do.
Yeah. And you know, once you're in third or fourth year, there's a lot more focus on the applications of chemistry for energy materials, catalysis, topics like that.
Definitely. So yeah, thanks again for joining us and really appreciate you taking the time to come on to our show.
Great. Thanks a lot, Alirad and Grimaud. It was nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you too. This concludes Research Review on CITR 101.9 FM. Again, my name is Alirad, and along with my co-host Grimaud, today we interviewed Dr. Mark McLaughlin, a professor of materials chemistry at UBC. We hope you join us again to listen to Research Review right here on CITR 101.9 FM 2 weeks from now on Wednesday at 6 p.m.